Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The World Bank, once the cause of major environmental problems, now is best positioned to treat them. This according to World Bank executive Patrick Cody. Cody says the Earth Summit has given the bank a new role to play. Also this time, Leanne DePatty, a fifth grader on the green team at Public School 16, expresses the essence of recycling.
And because I like to recycle, so it's this fun to help the world doing that.
Is it, you think it's important to recycle
this? Yeah.
Why?
Because you can make more things and not waste things.
Some of the stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. When world leaders gathered at the Earth Summit last June to chart the course of environmental protection into the next century, what emerged was a plan with a multi-billion-dollar price tag. But there was lack of consensus on long-range plans, and even less agreement on how to pay for them once they get underway. However, says E. Patrick Cody, United States Executive Director of the World Bank, the problem is not that the projects are too expensive.
What I would say, it's not money, but it's policy commitment and the avoiding of international gridlock among the various countries who are willing to come together to meet each other on the problem. But let's just take, for example, climate change. If you read the World Development Report for 1992 that the World Bank published, one of the things that comes out when you look at subsidies in the energy and power sector of developing countries, for the quantification of those subsidies is about $230 billion a year. In other words, by not charging appropriate prices for power, for energy, for for all those things, has the effect of putting a drain on those countries for $230 billion to support their social policies. And the byproduct of poor policy is that you encourage poor energy usage, poor energy conservation. So even the byproduct's not good because you don't get a solid allocation of resources. And if you had proper pricing, you'd get better allocation, less carbon dioxide, and therefore better climate. So the one thing you could do quickest is fix the policies, and it's not directly a money issue. It's a political issue. It's not an easy issue, but money won't solve that issue.
On the issue of biodiversity and its preservation, an area of major disagreement at the summit, Cody says this is one area where some additional monies will be needed.
I think there are some major ecosystems like the Amazon Basin or Indonesia which require some modest amount of money. I mean, it might, over a period of years, it might be several hundred millions of dollars to try to enhance the research capabilities and the training and the institutional ability to deal with it. But generally throughout the developing world, you've had a long, either in many countries, take Tanzania or Zambia and everything, or Philippines or even India or Thailand, you've had a national park system. You have it in Indonesia. So some of the real biodiversity hotspots are not new. I mean, the environmental organizations that care and have devoted themselves to biodiversity know where the hotspots are. And basically, it's affordable to identify and protect them and inventory. I mean, probably most of the money you need in biodiversity is to really begin to accelerate the data collection so that you know what you have in the way of species and things.
Climate change and protection of the ozone shield was another debate and area of disagreement. Cody says here, as established by the Montreal Protocol, the money is already there, though, as he says, the agreement has been slow getting off the mark. In short, Cody believes there are monies available for regional issues. They are just not distributed properly. And on a global scale, he says, there needs to be a change of policy at the government level. But the World Bank itself has been at fault in many instances. If you build it, they will come. This memorable line from the motion picture A Field of Dreams could well be applied to some of the World Bank's international projects. For example, huge sums of money lent for road building in the rainforest of Brazil, allowed urban populations and farmers into the wilderness. Trees were cut and burned to build the highways, and then cut and burned to clear for pasture. Without the roads, there would have been no cutting. And without the financial help from the World Bank, there would have been no roads. Cody says the bank now knows this.
Well, I think the World Bank was clearly the villain of the 70s and maybe the 80s, and whether it was the road construction in Rondônia in Brazil or the Narmada Dam, which is kind of the late 80s now, and other dam projects or irrigation. I think the World Bank has, you know, clearly has to take the physician's pledge of do no harm as a starting point. And I, you know, in neither to defend them but simply to explain them, I think that they didn't see the environmental as an economic issue, and so the byproducts of their projects were not taken account of.
Cody says there has been a sea change at the highest levels of the World Bank, but he says there are still many that are skeptical.
And I think the hardest thing for a lot of people to accept, particularly environmental groups who have seen the damage done by projects to which the World Bank's been associated with, is how can we turn over the future of this to the institution? I've taken a different point of view, and it's not a secret to my friends in the environmental community. I think that the World Bank is the only institution which has the resources, the experience, and the economic knowledge to bring together the environment into this. So I think the real positive outlook I have is that the World Bank, I think, can be in the position to help set emission standards in developing countries, to help resurrect environmental protection agencies and train and staff them and give them budget support, to help identify and protect biodiversity areas, to have sensible agricultural policies, not to build any more new roads in intact primary tropical forests. So I think what we do is we have to take the institution to which is the primary donor institution, and I would include the regional banks, and make those institutions responsive to environmental concerns, which I think are broadly shared on a global basis. And I think if that's done, you're kind of back to you don't need new money per se. I mean, there's kinds of ways, whether it's grant or concession, you may need some special instruments, but I think you've got the capacity and the institution to deal with it. Now, there's a lot of people. I mean, the World Bank when I got there, there were almost the environmental department was just kind of getting created. Now it's 140 people plus the regional. And that's a major repository of expertise and their ability to hire consultants. They have a small grants program for environmental groups. So, I mean, I think they're making some effort, but, you know, both... It's hard to bring these two sides back together again because the World Bank needs to be more open in how they do things.
The debate emerging from the Earth Summit centered on two issues, how much and who should pay. Developing nations argue that industrialized wealthy nations should pay a larger percentage based on the quantity of resources consumed. Industrialized nations argue that developing nations should carry their share based on higher population growth rates. Complicating the debate is lack of agreement over just how much money it would take to carry out the programs agreed to at the summit. Estimates range well over $100 billion. Cody says it is not reasonable to talk environmental dollar amounts until each individual nation has done all it can to make its own economy efficient and balanced.
If you look at developed countries, once you get to a certain level of economic prosperity or growth, you in fact can now afford the technologies of urban planning, better master. I mean, you can have your own efficiencies. So the record of the developed world is if you can create the right kind of economic fabric in society, you really almost need to do that to deal with the environment. So for countries where you can, in East Asia, whether it's Thailand or others that are on a good growth, or Latin America, if you somewhat optimistic, Eastern Europe and even Russia, I think there's lots of room to be optimistic that the scope of the global environmental needs is manageable.
Cody, however, refuses to put an actual number down on paper to look at the sales slip, if you will. Instead, he again suggests that combining cost-saving measures within the economies of individual nations with more effective implementation of existing programs, including those from the World Bank, the overall total will be something well within the budget of the international community. E. Patrick Cody is U.S. Executive Director of the World Bank, and he spoke to us while on a speaking tour at Skidmore College, Saratoga Springs, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Across America, companies are on the move, seeking new home states with fewer regulations and lower taxes. In several Western states, lawmakers are considering proposals that would force these companies to disclose their past histories of compliance with environmental regulations before operating permits are granted. But as Bob Ria reports, these bad actor bills are getting some mixed reviews.
Basically, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get at companies who have convictions.
Lobbying efforts like this one at the state capitol in Helena, Montana, are being played out in the halls of several Western legislatures this year. Citizens are asking their elected officials to support legislation that would require companies wishing to operate in their states to disclose their past compliance record with state and federal environmental laws.
Once that disclosure is done by the applicant for the permit, the state permitting agency would, in the event of a previous civil or administrative violation, have the discretion to consider that in deciding whether to grant the permit.
In Montana, sponsor of the bill, Democratic Senator Steve Daugherty, explains the legislation to the Senate Natural Resources Committee.
But if there have been criminal violations, you're not going to get the permit to do business in Montana.
But the legislation met strong opposition from industry lobbyists. They claim its standards are too stringent. Jerome Anderson represents Shell Western, a subsidiary of Shell Oil.
It also not only covers the company itself, it covers its principals, any of its principal officers, it covers any subcontractors, it covers any associates, it covers anybody that the company does business with. It really is just a far-encompassing umbrella.
While many may characterize this bill as anti-business, I would suggest that it is good for Montana's business.
Jean Clark and her family operate a cattle and dude ranch near McLeod, Montana. She testified in favor of the bill.
I draw your attention to the statement of intent, which reads, to foster a business climate in Montana that favors responsible business operators. To ensure Montana's long-term sustainable economy, we must insist that today's businesses operate responsibly.
But in the end, lawmakers voted to kill the Montana legislation. However, in North Dakota, similar legislation appears to have a better chance of being enacted. Controversial waste disposal projects have led residents to take action. They've gotten lawmakers to introduce a bad actor bill aimed at the waste industry. The legislation has been given a favorable recommendation by Senate and House committees. It would require the state health department to deny a permit if the company has intentionally misrepresented or concealed environmental violations. But the issue is not limited to North Dakota.
It calls upon the permitting agency, which in this case is the Board of
South Dakota lawmakers are also struggling with the waste problem. Republican Senator Keith Paisley has introduced a bill similar to those in Montana and North Dakota.
And starting many years ago, we expressed a willingness to be a host state for whatever, and that willingness seems to persist in the eyes of a great number of companies who have come in not only under a presumed contractor with private lands, but also with the Indian reservations. Well, they've zeroed in on us. There's just no question, and we want to in some way control our own future, our own destiny, by knowing who it is that we're dealing with.
Paisley says passage of the legislation this year is crucial, because federal standards that take effect in October will completely change the dynamics of waste management. Instead of many small landfills controlled by local governments, regional landfills will be established to serve the entire state. For example, South Dakota will have approximately 16. Haisley says the regional approach will not be as closely regulated as the current system. Although the final decision on bad actor legislation in the Dakotas is uncertain, it is clear that efforts to demand more accountability and protection from government regulating agencies is gaining support across the region. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Bob Reha.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and recycling now are the four R's children must learn in school anymore.
We're doing it because to save the trees.
Max Turner is a fourth grader now at Public School 16 on the southwest side of Albany, New York. Public School 16 was one of a small group of schools in the city chosen last year to pilot a new program for recycling aseptic juice containers and milk cartons.
Well, it's important to do this because the air purifies our air. I mean, the trees purify our air, and they also give us fruit and stuff. And if you waste a lot of paper, there sooner or later there'll be none left. And you couldn't, like, have bananas, apples, oranges.
2 years ago, the Aseptic Packaging Council had set up a small-scale program in two schools in California. The program caught the eye of the United States Conference of Mayors. Now, the Aseptic Packaging Council and the Conference of Mayors have collaborated on the National Recycling in Schools program. The participating schoolchildren work on a green team to go around the classrooms and the cafeteria to collect the used milk and juice cartons. Max is one of the key players at School 16. Dave Gatton has had an important role as senior environmental advisor for the mayor's conference.
We now, as a nation, generate over, somewhere in between 180 and 200 million tons of municipal solid waste a year. We're running out of landfills to put it in. We have stricter U.S. Environmental Protection Agency regulations that are going to close many of those landfills. So we need to find a way to instill in our children a recycling ethic that makes them exciting and excited about recycling.
The U.S. Conference of Mayors conducts research on various topics for the nation's mayors and their administrations. Gatton says solid waste is an issue facing the nation's cities and their mayors, and the conference has been researching options in solid waste management. Aseptic packaging is a relatively new process. The Institute of Food Technologists says aseptic packaging represents the first major advance in food packaging in 50 years, more significant even than frozen concentrated juices and microwave ovens. The process involves very rapid heating and very rapid cooling of the liquid as it is placed in individual containers made of cardboard, polyethylene, and aluminum. The product remains good on the shelf up to a year without refrigeration or preservatives. Critics of the process say it uses too much material and leaves too much unrecyclable material behind, many little plastic cartons versus a few big glass containers. These concerns, both for the aseptic and the waxed boxes for milk, were valid until recently. Now, says Marshall Cohen, president of the Aseptic Packaging Council in Washington, the little cartons actually are a very much desired material for recycling.
Aseptic packaging and milk cartons both contain a very high-grade valuable paper fiber. And it is that paper fiber which has a market that companies want to put into recycled products. And in both types of containers, the printing for the dairy or the orange juice company or whatever, is not done on the paper, it's done on the polyethylene so that no de-inking is required. And when these packages come out of the recycling process, the fiber is bright, clean, strong, and has a very strong, good market value.
The process of recycling the aseptic packages involves a technique known as hydropulping, invented 20 years ago. Using it, recyclers are able to separate the components of the box, 70% paper, 24% polyethylene, and 6% aluminum, into all its parts, each retrievable and valuable on the market. Cohen says the success of the program in California and now in Albany, New York, with the help of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, has taken the recycling from the classroom and out into the streets.
We have about 90 communities in western Massachusetts serving several hundred thousand households in curbside programs. We have 40 or 50 towns in Connecticut. We have Mercer County, New Jersey is just about to start for a couple hundred thousand households. The entire Los Angeles School District collects these materials for recycling. We have several hundred thousand communities in Orange County in California. And in the Portland, Seattle area, we have a substantial number of schools and communities also doing recycling.
In addition to using advanced recycling technologies at the mill, Dave Gatton says this project also represents a breakthrough in cooperation between the public sector, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and the private sector, the Aseptic Packaging Council.
It's important for the public to understand that recycling is by its very nature a public-private effort. While the public sector might be involved in the collection and in some instances the processing of materials, if that material isn't then taken to a market and made into another product by the private sector, we really haven't recycled. So by definition, recycling is public and private.
Until recently, however, we in the public have expected industry to provide the right products and the right packaging to make recycling easier. Industry, on the other hand, has been slow to enter an unproven market. The result has been a sort of gridlock. But, says Marshall Cohen, this move by the Aseptic Packaging Council is one indication industry is eager to work with policymakers in government, whether in Washington or at the state's capitals.
What I say to policymakers and legislators and others is let's work together. Let us tell you what we've learned, how we know we can put these kinds of programs together, and how, from the government's perspective, you can help. You can write policies that encourage the collection of this type of material. You can make sure that communities have the ability to add materials to their recycling streams. And so to keep it at a cooperative basis. And we find a fair responsiveness by policymakers around the country to that. And they're beginning to recognize that they can't just say, you got to do X by this date and assume that it will happen, because it's not a realistic way to approach it.
If the children at Public School 16 are an indication, the future of public-private cooperation indeed is bright.
Fun, and because I like to recycle, so it's just fun to help the world doing that.
Is it, you think it's important to recycle this?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you can make more things and not waste things.
Leanne DePatty, a fifth grader on the Green Team, each Friday. Will Leanne be an industry chief executive or an elected official? Whatever is in her future, one thing is already in her present. Recycling is not just policy or technology, it is lifestyle. One, the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the Aseptic Packaging Council now hopes will spread across the nation as willingly. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on The Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Hello to friends listening to The Environment Show for the first time on WCSB in Cleveland, Ohio. Coming up soon, next week, a conversation with Dr. John Gibbons, special advisor to the White House on science issues and new uses for your old Levi jeans. That's next time on The Environment Show. We'll be looking for you. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, address your questions and your comments both to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 167. That's 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, 167. Well, The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.